I noticed quite a few new faces here, so I'm going to do a little bit of review from last night as we go along, or as we start out. This is the second in a series on tolerance. Last night I spoke of what I've called original tolerance, which I'll touch on a bit here, but the brunt of this talk will be on what I've called new tolerance. It's not just my word term, but a lot of people have recognized a change in the meaning and attitude to tolerance. We talked last time about it, the word tolerance coming from the Latin word tolerare, which is the verb to bear with or to endure. To endure someone who's different and whose difference is painful and objectionable to you and difficult for you. And we focus on not just tolerance in general, but on tolerance to do with religion. Tolerance to do with religious difference. Tolerance is an important capacity because there's an enormous amount of interpersonal pain in the world. An enormous amount of friction between these millions and millions of people who live side by side with each other, and even at distance with each other, but have interaction with each other in ways that are painful. Some of that difference, or a good deal of that difference, is over religion and over religious issues and friction to do with religious issues. Friction to do with how one defines tolerance itself. I think that's increasing because the meaning of tolerance is shifting. I mentioned last night the lines from Daniel Taylor in his book, Is God Tolerant? He talks about intolerance is now the only sin left in the world, where nothing else counts as sin, nothing else is something, anything you need to object to, but intolerance is the only sin left. And it goes on to say, America is sick of intolerant people, and it's not going to tolerate them anymore. And he's tapping into some of the struggles over just how we process, how we deal with these differences between us. I spoke of last night three kinds of tolerance: legal tolerance, which is that different religions have a right to freely express their faith without persecution or promotion from the state. Legal tolerance is talking about government policy, whether it be local or federal or whatever, which gives permission and protects religious diversity. That's what legal tolerance is, and that's, as I said last night, the United States took a very, very significant leadership in that, and the First Amendment represents an amazing statement of the fact that the government isn't going to mess with your religion, but will actually allow you to freedom of expression of your religious faith with ultimate limits. But the first thing is legal tolerance. Then there's personal tolerance, which is related, but is, on the other hand, a very different reality, which is how you actually treat other people, you yourself, me, myself, how we actually treat other people who are different in their religious convictions to ourselves. And personal tolerance means treating other people of different religious convictions with respect, as equals, and as possible friends. In other words, it's not allowing religious difference to intercede and be an ultimate block in relationship. The first two kinds of tolerance, these first two kinds of tolerance, legal tolerance and personal tolerance, are what make up what I've called original tolerance, the way tolerance has always been used, or always for the last several hundred years. Having to do with how we treat people whose religious commitments are different from our own and in some ways difficult for us. Then there's the third kind of tolerance, which I've called worldview tolerance, which gets much more into the new tolerance. a tolerance of others' ideas and actions, accepting other people's ideas and actions as of equal truth and value to your own. Okay? Not just accepting them as people, but accepting their ideas and values as equal in value and truth to your own. This is the main emphasis of the new tolerance, not so much on persons, but on persons' ideas, commitments, behavior, and so forth. It has to do with celebrating or affirming what is diverse. Tolerance today, and this is why I've been interested in it and lectured on it on and off here and there for years now, is a really important issue in terms of the Christian faith interacting with the non-Christian world around us. Nietzsche wrote in the 1870s that what decides against Christianity now is our taste, not our arguments. Really interesting. Taste, not our arguments. What he meant was that it's not arguments, disproofs, anti-God ideas, attacks on the Bible, the church, faith, that persuaded people to dismiss the Christian faith. It was their desires, values, preferences, feelings, stories, associations that gave Christianity a bad taste in their mouth and made it therefore unattractive and implausible for them to believe. Now, I trust that he was probably right. He was a pretty astute observer then in the 1870s, but I think, though he was right then, I think it's probably more right now, more the case now, that what counts against us is less our arguments and more people's bad taste from seeing Christians, hearing Christians, what do we believe, what do we not believe, and so on. Which means that we're not dealing with a dry set of cognitive problems that we've got to come up with just clear solutions to that we can put in words broken into paragraphs and so forth. It's a whole person reality. It's a whole church social reality that we're dealing with. One of the things that is most likely to give Christianity a bad taste in people's mouths today is the conviction that Christians are intolerant. That would make sense if intolerance is the only sin left, and Christians are known for the one sin that people, especially for the one sin that people think is left. It's I think probably from most of our experience we can know it's one of the worst things that could be said about you against that counts most heavily against you if it sticks to you. Why bother listening to anybody who's intolerant? That's because if they're intolerant, they must also be bigoted, arrogant, ethnocentric, and neurotic. As we're saying, you know, the idea is that that intolerance is the last sin left. Many Christians value tolerance and think of themselves as tolerant people, and probably are tolerant people, but are surprised and confused to get beaten over the head with the brickbat of intolerance in unexpected ways at times. And that's what I want to get at. Why are we being beaten up, and it's surprising us? Why are these? Where does this idea of intolerance come from when we think we're being tolerant? And I'm going to get a bit of a running start from last night and mention a couple of things that I've just to give us some momentum here before we get into newer material. I mentioned some things about the American history of the interaction between religious truth and tolerance. And I'll just touch on some of that now, taking a metaphor from the sociologist Stan Gady, a Christian sociologist. He tracks the relationship between religious truth and tolerance as an odd marriage in American history, starting out with conviction of religious truth being a very, very strong, powerful commitment religious tolerance being a very weak and almost unknown possibility in the early 17th century. But it works into what he would say an odd marriage. I won't go try and unpack this. But by the time you get through the 1700s, there's more and more, not so much from the development of ideas, but from the necessity of people in different colonies built around different religious commitments having to relate to each other, having to connect with each other. More and more awareness of religious tolerance was forced on them, and more of the reality of that tolerance became necessary to them. And so by the time of the revolution and the formation of the Constitution, you have an actual sort of semi-uncomfortable but also functional marriage between religious tolerance and conviction of religious truth. He would see the First Amendment as expressing that. It can express religious conviction and confidence in truth because you're free to express your religion. The First Amendment is guarantees the free exercise of your religious expression, and protects even minority religious expressions by virtue of not establishing any religious institution or theology or whatever. Prohibiting the federal government from establishing any one religion. That means no national church. Imagine trying to, if you know anything about the time of in late 18th century America, imagine what they would have gotten into if they tried to have a national church. Getting all these 13 colonies on board with one church? Are you kidding? It would have just an absolute joke. So it was a force of necessity, but also it was framed in a very positive sense with hope that it would work, and I think it has worked for quite a while. I see the First Amendment as something I really agree with. The 19th century carries on, and Stan Gaty in his model sees freedom getting stronger and stronger. Freedom and tolerance, as you are going together, because they're totally interdependent. America becomes, it builds its national identity around its own freedom, which depends on its religious tolerance. Its mythology and folklore are all keyed into this by the middle of the early 1800s. It becomes our sense of our own character. Freedom and tolerance being inseparable. By the late 19th century, you begin to see great weakness on the side of religious conviction, confidence in religious conviction. In theology, in philosophy, in biblical studies, we spoke about this a bit last night, in literature and the arts, is great growth of doubt and uncertainty about religious truth. Can we trust the Bible? Can we trust the church? Is it really giving us a message from outside? Or are we left alone to figure out what in the world we're doing here without any message from above? And so you see truth, confidence in truth, not just in Christianity, because it's not just in Christianity, but in truth in general, begins to be lost. Truth in on big issues, on major issues of ultimate truth. So ultimate truth, and along with God, gets marginalized and pushed to the side. I think more abandoned than not so much deceased, but divorced and abandoned. But mysteriously left as sort of a mysterious needed presence, and I'll come back to this. This was a vast and wide process. We spoke about it a bit in the discussion last night. Many, many tributaries have gone into it, meaning rivers, little rivers leading into big rivers, leading into bigger rivers, and so forth. It's a very, very complex thing that took place. Much of the work of Francis Schaeffer, for example, if any of you are familiar with his work, got lots of it up here, was in tracking this development, the loss of concept of truth. He saw a line of despair, meaning when people would lose the sense of being able to have any rational way of understanding the big questions of meaning, truth, moral right and wrong, etc. And so he spent a lot of time working on it. I'll just give you one example to illustrate. It's been used many times by different people, but I still want to lay it out to see what that we're left with: a huge emphasis on freedom, but without truth, without confidence in truth. This is from a graduate student's speech at the Harvard commencement in the late 1980s, and I think I have this on here for you to see. Yeah. This is just, I'd like to have heard the rest of the speech, and I've seen this quoted many times, but I've never come up with a name of who it was that said it. But it goes like this. They tell us it's heresy to suggest the superiority of some value. Fantasy to believe in moral argument. Slavery to submit to a judgment sounder than your own. The freedom of our day is the freedom to devote yourself to any values we please on the mere condition that we do not believe them to be true. Now, that's worth, I'm going to leave it up for a minute. It's worth meditating on a little bit. Because with tolerance and freedom triumphant over truth, you can't suggest one value is superior to another value without restricting freedom and tolerance. You can't trust moral argument to arrive at moral truth, because that assumes there is a moral truth out there to be arrived at. Nor can you bow to an authority higher than yourself, than your own judgment. Where in the world would you find such an authority? How could there be such an authority? But whatever you come up with, you can't believe any of it is true. You know, so it's a very, very strong, obviously completely self-contradicting as it's intended to be, but a statement of someone speaking from within a modern secular university and having been received the ideas that are just swimming, that one is swimming in this setting. I want to think about multiculturalism as one of the tributaries here that have gone in to separate religious tolerance from truth. With all the waves of immigration into the United States from Europe and from around the world, from its inception, but also particularly from the 1970s on, the question is how to make ethnic minorities feel at home here and more a part of who they can be in America and yet maintain their own identity. Multiculturalism is a well-intended attempt to address this reality and issue. I'm not against the idea of multiculturalism, at least as the meaning the word carries. But a number of people, among them, for example, the sociologist James Davidson Hunter from the University of Virginia, who's a Christian sociologist, maintains that it has had a far-reaching costs that we don't usually understand and we usually overlook. His grievance is especially that multiculturalism has degraded and devalued the depth of all cultures, people's culture of origin as well as Western culture to which they have come, at least if they're here in the United States. We can start with an illustration, which isn't the origin of multiculturalism, but it's an interesting way to get a hold of some of the ideas. Start with a children's preschool. In complete innocence, children preschool are usually exposed to the food, clothing, music, dance, etc., of as many cultures as are represented by the students or in the area. and they'll bring in Mexican food for lunch and Mexican clothes and maybe some music. The next day it'll be, or next week it'll be Chinese, the next week it'll be Greek or something like this. And the idea is that the kids will learn from looking at bits of lifestyle from different places, what's it like to do ordinary life from different parts of the world. This is a sort of a show and tell in the classroom starting in preschool. And the idea is to help kids understand and appreciate people from other places and other cultures, understand different lifestyles or ways they do ordinary things, encouraging them to relate to people from different backgrounds with different ways in a positive way without prejudice. This is wonderful. Children love it. I have no problem with it. I see nothing whatever sinister about this, okay? I'm not trying to make it into something sinister. But what happens if you take this attitude to lifestyle and extend it and inflate it to include the far deeper realities of each of those cultures? Like, for example, their different religious ideas, worldviews, moral values. Then worldview and religious differences are reduced to being like the superficial lifestyle differences, such as diet, dress, dance, music, so on, that we see as we look at the surface, as the preschool child has looked at the surface. A culture's religion becomes only, well, it's the way this group of people have dealt with just universal human problems of wanting purpose in life, social cohesion to hold the society together, and an explanation for death. And so religions are looked at as just a way each culture has taken universal human needs and answered them in a way that fits best with the comings and goings, economic structure, so on, of that culture. So no moral or religious beliefs or truths are better or worse, more or less true than any others, just as we must respect them as we do respect different people's food, clothing, and music. Just as you would never say that only Mexican food is real food, or only Indian music is real music, so you would never say that one person's religion is the only true religion and somebody else's isn't. In other words, you don't introduce true and false. You don't use one to exclude the other. The key issue is we don't exclude. One religious teaching could never be true in a way that would exclude or make another false. The idea is that you can freely cherry-pick elements from any culture and put them together yourself. Like, if you have enough money, you could go for months in Boston to different restaurants from foreign places, if you had enough money to do it. But you should never think that you get deep into Brazilian culture by spending an evening at a Brazilian restaurant, or Chinese culture by eating in a Chinese restaurant, or whatever. It's pretty superficial, and we don't go very far down. And this is what Hunter was objecting to, is that in multiculturalism, everything is kept very superficial, and all cultures, the understanding of all cultures, is kept superficial in the interest of pulling people together. We might have sushi one day, pizza the next, fajitas the next, and it might be fine for our diet. Who knows? But if we start to think about religion in the same way, we come up with what's been called designer religion, which means we sing in the church choir, we also do Buddhist meditation, we also believe in crystals, and their power in reincarnation, angels, and Adam Smith's invisible hand, which makes all our greed serve the common good. Now, seeing, we can embrace all these and never see tension between them, because they're all held very superficially, and our involvement in each one is very superficial. Compared to, I want to say, real people actually involved in Buddhist meditation full time, in terms of a real belief conviction. So no no theological or moral beliefs or ideals are better or worse than any others. We must respect them all as we respect different cultures, choices of food, clothing, and so forth. The meaning of sex for some is only to have children. For others, it is to have entertainment, to have fun without commitments. For others, it's to express a deep, caring, and lifelong intimacy. Who's to say who's right? Who's to judge? The great mistake is ethnocentrism, where we come in and say, this is right, that is wrong, this is good, that is bad. And we're just loading our culture onto other cultures. And our culture should have no particular authority more than anybody else. Our background, what I learned when I grew up, I'm just loading that accident onto judgment, excluding other people. Because we mustn't see substantive differences here in these areas. When these are ideas are combined with the impact of, and I won't have enough time at all to get into this, what's been called the therapeutic revolution, the tremendous growth in the role of psychology and how we see things in psychological categories, and who are the experts that are most consulted on most of our human problems, no longer the minister, it's the psychologist or the expert in the human sciences somewhere. The therapeutic revolution tends to, it's a big thing so you can't narrow it down too much, say the thing that really matters is that nothing matters as long as people feel good about themselves. Self-esteem is the integrating thing from which all other growth comes, from the lack of which comes all our dysfunction. So self-esteem is the center of everything, becomes a moral imperative. Added this into the multicultural mix, there's a tremendous danger of giving people offense, of making people feel offended and so lower their sense of self-esteem. Offended about their culture, about any detail of their lives or whatever, giving offense is confused, I think, with hate, with all sorts of things like this. Truth, as Christians have historically understood it, is gone here. Is subsumed under something different. Christians will always be in trouble within this framework, because as at least evangelical Christians, those of us here who are evangelical Christians, we do discriminate morally. We do discriminate theologically. We do think that some differences are deep and substantive differences between people that are important to hold to. Christians will differ over truth claims, moral views with a lot of people. That differing risks offending people. Doesn't need to. Depends on the relationship we've got, all sorts of variables, but it runs that risk. Now, what are some of the implications of this as we see it spinning out? The rise of tolerance and the collapse of religious truth. What happens when tolerance is the only virtue? That's to me, the kind of mentality we're getting into. Nothing is fully developed, I don't think, and held in a systematic way by our neighbors, but there's something very deep here that's seeping in. When sin is the only sin left, when intolerance is the only sin left, that points out that tolerance is the only virtue. Let me look a little bit at this. For tolerance to be tolerant in the full modern sense, it must not have other claims to go with it. Modern tolerance has divorced and abandoned and deserted those other truth claims. Tolerance in the modern sense can be pure tolerance only if it frees itself from these other truths. For example, if the truth claims of feminism or environmentalism stand with tolerance, you run the danger of being intolerant of anti-feminists or anti-environmentalists. So you're no longer tolerant if you think dimly of people who aren't feminists or who are not on board with environmental care. Your tolerance is threatened by having any other convictions go along with tolerance. Some seem to say that I think very few people are really looking at this in right in the face and seeing where it's actually going. But some will say, I've heard somebody say, tolerance is all we need. If we're sufficiently accepting of diversity, we'll be okay. We will have a civil society. Now, tolerance alone, and this is a really important piece today, tolerance alone can't mean anything at all. To say that someone is tolerant is like saying someone is very. What do you do with someone who's very? They might want to know very what? Because, my goodness, it could be anything. And so with tolerance, you'll want to ask, tolerant? Tolerant of what? Tolerant of other people's suffering? Tolerant of rape? Of racism? Of genocide? No, that's not what we mean. But that is what is meant by tolerance standing alone. That's the problem. People say, no, not at all. But that, the minute they said that, they brought in a moral reality underneath it to enable them to say no, to be horrified by rape, racism, and genocide. But where does the horror come from? It doesn't come from tolerance. It comes from some other moral framework that they're bringing, they put basically under the table. This is why I said God or higher truth is dismissed, it's abandoned, but it stays mysteriously hidden. You see, tolerance carries no moral content at all unless it's a part of a larger moral order. That's just what the new tolerance has abandoned. It has no moral content unless it has the authority to draw a line somewhere between what is tolerable and what is intolerable, and to say why. It needs a worldview or a foundation which can value justice, which can value peace, which can value human beings as human beings because they're valuable, value love, truth, care for the environment, and so on. Then, if we have these things grounded, then we can use tolerance. Then we can see where tolerance is appropriate and where intolerance is appropriate. The abandoned and divorced idea of ultimate truth shouts out from its place of abandonment, needing to be recognized. Because tolerance alone can make no distinctions between good and evil. If tolerance is alone, it allows the human sense of moral freedom to spin off in any direction, making arbitrary commitments to almost anything. If tolerance is the only sin left, the idea of tolerance bears much too much weight for it to hold together, much more than it can bear. The accusation of intolerance can be used to condemn anything. Now, new tolerance is also not as much to do, and I've said this before, but I want to focus on it more here, not as much to do with people as with ideas and actions. The original tolerance, I've tried to say, has to do with how you treat people, either the government or the individual. New tolerance is much more how we treat their beliefs and actions. Just a couple of examples here. In a statement done by the National Endowment for the Arts, the NEA, wrote it at its endowment, "The arts and the humanities reflect the high place accorded to the American people by the The arts and the humanities reflect the high place accorded by the American people to the nation's rich cultural heritage and to the fostering of mutual respect for the diverse beliefs and values of all persons and groups." Now, that sounds wonderful and accepting, and so on, until you realize that you're being called to respect not people, but the diverse values of all persons and groups in America. How do you do that? It sounds as if we're meant to respect all beliefs and values, including the Ku Klux Klan, including neo-Nazis, including Al-Qaeda, if they happen to be here on our shores. We must respect the diverse beliefs and values. Why? Why in the world must we respect all these values? And is it right? Is it possible? I don't think it's possible. Is it right? Think of the people who we disrespect and devalue if we respect the Ku Klux Klan or the neo-Nazis. Now, this is not the intention of the authors of that statement at all. They'd be horrified to be racist or whatever, called racist. And so I'm not trying to impugn evil, direct evil motivation on them. I'm trying to impugn naivete to them to know what in the world it is that they're saying and not realizing what they're saying. They put what they need under the table and let it not be part of the conversation. Because they've not actually dared to fully abandon the truth of some moral order, despite claiming to abandon the truth of a moral order. Reliance on the abandoned partner of God, partner which is God or some moral order, is put under the table and kept there. So I want to say there's integrity problems here, and we need to really ask questions. Where are some of these things coming from? Three important terms, and this I've been laying out for years, and so some of you may have suffered through this before, but I have to do it here because it really is an important way of getting a hold of what's coming at us. Three important terms: pluralism, relativism, and conversion. Pluralism, religious pluralism, is, as I'm using it, and this is not the only way to use it, but as I'm using it, is a very simple, undisputable, observable fact. There's a plurality of religions out there. There's Jews, there's Hindus, there's Christians, there's Scientologists, there's Buddhists, there's Muslims, or whatever, and that's all I mean by that. It's no longer Christendom when Christianity is the one religion going. That was ended a long time ago, at least in this neck of the woods. I'm using this as simple as a sociological fact, okay, which is uncontroversial. What is controversial, though, is how we understand that plurality, how we understand that diversity. For example, are they all true? Are none of them true? Is one true and the rest false? Are some more true than others? Are three of them true, like the three monotheistic religions, and the rest false? Or does nobody know at all? Now that is six possible paradigms for understanding religious pluralism. Are any of them right? Is one of them right? Highly controversial which one of those paradigms you take, which one of those models you take for understanding the plurality of religion. Religious relativism is one possible way, which actually combines the first two, that all are true and none are true. Relativism sort of combines that all are true and none are true. Relativism is not a social fact, but it is a far-reaching philosophical doctrine that interprets this social fact. It tells you how different religions should be understood, and as such as a kind of an uber-religion. It says that no one has the ability to know who God is or what ultimate truth is anyway. No one has the equipment. So, says relativism, it makes no sense to speak of one religion being true and another being false, in the sense that one could ever exclude another. But they're all true in that they do, that they're all false, really, in that nobody really knows who God is or what ultimate truth is. But they're all true in that they all do more or less the same job and satisfy the same set of human needs. They express human longings, codify them, and process them, and so forth, and put them together and give social cohesion. Different religions at bottom are all alike in that they're different cultures' attempts to name what is unnameable and to put together a sense of purpose and so on, relative to the needs of that particular culture. This is the lowest common denominator of all religions. and as some have said, it's if you like chocolate ice cream better than vanilla ice cream, that doesn't mean chocolate ice cream is true ice cream and vanilla ice cream is false ice cream. But that is how they see the evangelical Christian from the stance of relativism. that we, by saying our faith is true and some any other faith is not true, it's like you being a crusader for chocolate ice cream and giving your life as a mission to convince everybody that chocolate ice cream is the only true ice cream. So they see us as ridiculous. They see us making what the philosophers would call a category error, which means asking questions like, what is the color of geology? In other words, it ain't there. can't be done. You've made a mistake way back, and you don't know what you've done with yourself. Since no one knows who God is or is not, all religions are equally valid and invalid. The differences between them are only accidents of time and place. And it's impossible to be wrong about religion in any way that matters, because nobody has a clue anyway. Relativism, loosely understood, has an enormous influence in our society today and in Europe, Western society, especially among educated people, many of whom might never use the word or even think necessarily in these categories, but are deeply influenced by it and by its taste. Think back to Nietzsche here, which seems to be inclusive, non-judgmental, accepting, and humble. Relativism makes tremendous claims for epistemological humility. In other words, in our knowledge, we're humble in what we claim to know. Let me get fueled here. Religious conversion. Religious conversion has a bad name in our society. It, for the same reason that missionary has a bad name. Almost a sort of a swear word, along with proselytize. It's associated with colonialism, all sorts of bad stuff, and politically incredibly incorrect stuff. the idea of conversion, and let's just think why. Why is conversion seen as a bad word? The idea of conversion doesn't threaten or challenge pluralism. Conversion assumes and depends on pluralism, a plurality of options out there, real and deep differences between them. No one would convert unless they thought there was an important difference between what they grew up with or what they hold now and what they're about to embrace. That has to be a pretty big difference, especially if it's something they grew up with. Then they would have to say it's important enough to leave, perhaps family or culture or friends and so on, and embrace something different. And it had all sorts of social consequences. If religions are different, though, conversion makes perfect sense if you're persuaded is one is true and the other that you have believed is not true. As with important ideas about just about any subject you can think of. Economics, politics, law, aesthetics, gardening, nutrition. Look at these fields. There's people who differ with each other of what's true in each of these fields and argue with each other and say, no, you're wrong, I'm right, and this is why. And that's allowed. And that actually is a good thing because these fields progress because of these arguments and go forward. But it's not allowed somehow when it comes to religion. And as I said, the differences between them could be so important that it's worth breaking with your friends and family and culture, changing your ultimate loyalty. It could even make you try to persuade somebody else of the same truth that you've embraced yourself. And you would do in what's called proselytism, or unless you have that word loaded as a negative word. So what I'm saying here is that pluralism does not negate conversion at all, but is the ground from which conversion is possible and makes sense, is understandable and actually necessary. Tolerance isn't offended or challenged by pluralism at all, as long as everybody treats people with respect and dignity. No one has. There's been no intolerance in the original tolerance sense, as long as people are treated with respect and dignity. It's relativism that takes offense at conversion. Relativism sees it as evidence of ethnocentrism and intolerance, like converting from thinking that chocolate ice cream is the only ice cream to thinking that vanilla ice cream is the only ice cream. Conversion threatens the foundation of relativist doctrine because it assumes that one religious commitment can be actually different, seriously different, in ultimate ways to another. If all religions are equally valid and invalid, why in the world go through the trauma of changing one's religious loyalty? So it's relativism that's challenged by conversion, proselytizing, and the very concept of Christian mission. But religious pluralism leaves us with very challenging and uncomfortable choices about what direction our lives should take. It means that we need to make choices about God that could be wrong, and that being wrong could have very serious consequences. If there really is pluralism, in the sense of difference between different options, there is no safe default position. There's no safe default position religiously. That means it behooves us, everybody, to think through where is my loyalty and why, and it matters. By comparison, relativism lets you off the hook of saying you can forget about the whole God question. Nobody really knows. You can be completely wrong, but it won't make any difference because nobody has a clue. You can ignore God and have it not matter. That's another great attraction to relativism. It is a default position where everybody can relax and say it doesn't really make a long-term difference. Relativism, despite all its humility, openness, and so forth, destroys pluralism. It appears humble, generous, tolerant, non-excluding, non-judgmental, and marvelous, exactly what the world needs. The world with all its conflicts, what we need is just this sort of thing. That's why it offers such a sweet taste. And it says, as it says, all religions are true, we accept and celebrate them all in their diversity. But in fact, relativism, as I'll try to get at, as you can guess I'm heading, it is not what it seems. This is a false taste. I think about two illustrations coming from relativism themselves. Relativists themselves. There's a very familiar one that I'm sure most of the people in this room have heard and had told to them. That all religions are like different roads up the same mountain. At the top of the mountain is God. People in their limitations and their ignorance think that they are on the only road that there is up the mountain because that's all they can see. There's trees and forests and rocks and so on. They can't see any other roads. Only at the top of the mountain, when they get to God, they realize that everybody is going to the top of the mountain. All these roads of different religions that we thought were completely different and exclusive of ours are going to the same destination at the top of the mountain where they meet God. Now this sounds humble and generous and accepting. If you find you are one of those roads and you think you're on the only road, this is an illustration that makes you hang your head in shame. How could I have been so ethnocentric? How could I have been so self-centered and so forth to believe this? But we have to ask a question of this person. I think this is really important to do if someone tells us this. Where is the person standing who describes this picture to you? He or she has got to be in an airplane looking down on the whole thing. How come the relativist who tells us is the only one to have an airplane? To be up there and look down and see all these roads and all these people in their ignorance, sweating, carrying their picnics, whatever, up the mountain, thinking they're on the only route. The people on these routes up the mountain include all the religious leaders of the world. And they, in ignorance, don't know what you know as you look down on the mountain. Ironically, what I'm trying to say is this shows exactly what it's not intended to show about relativism. It shows that relativism is imposing a single over religion from above on all the plurality of religions of the world. It's imposing uniformity on the diversity that's actually there. So it's doing the opposite of what the relativist is claiming to be able to do. It's an imposition of uniformity. And what most believers in those religious traditions do not agree with. The religious leaders of the world are mistaken because of their limited perspective. Of course, they couldn't see from where they are, where they're walking. So their perspectives are excluded. The relativist gives us the true picture because he or she is evidently free from the limitations and fallibilities of the rest of the human race. And you just want to ask, how come? How come? Where does this immunity come from? Second illustration. The religions of the world are like blind men investigating an elephant. I'm sure we've heard that. I think it goes back to Jainism for several thousand years, actually. Blind men feeling an elephant, trying to figure out what in the world is there. One grabs the leg, the other the trunk, the other the ear, the other the side, the tail, or whatever, and they come up with all sorts of strange ideas about what they've got. One thinks it's a tree, somebody else thinks it's a snake, somebody else sees it as a leaf, somebody else a barn door, a rope, whatever. You can imagine all the different things you could come up with here. And they're all wrong because they really need to combine insights and so on. But there's the same question you have to ask. How does the teller of this story know that it is an elephant that the blind men are investigating? How do you know that it really was an elephant? Well, you have to be the only sighted person in the religious world of the blind. How does this person get to be the only sighted person around? So again, it's forcing an over-religion, an exclusive and absolute claim from above on top of the religious plurality of the world religions. These religious leaders were mistaken. Of course they were mistaken. They couldn't see. So their views are excluded. But the teller of the story sets us all right because he or she can see. So relativism sounds ever so humble, unwilling to exclude anybody, but actually there's nothing humble about it. It produces a single vision of God and ultimate truth which excludes the convictions of most of the rest of the world. I call this the overbite of relativism. It assumes for itself the very status that it criticizes in others. The relativist is a closet absolutist or a stealth absolutist, not so humble as its initial taste. And let me just think of the idea here of stealth relativism. Tolerance is a much nicer word, which sounds much better than relativism sounds. I may be completely wrong, but my hunch is that the word relativism became less used after 9/11. It's just my impression. I think people saw, whoa, this is another radical worldview intruding. Look what happened. And people were a little bit more cautious about using the word relativism. That's just my total hunch. It comes from no survey of print journalism or anything. But my point here about relativism is not to criticize it for being intolerant, because it excludes me and other people and our religious beliefs. That's not the problem. It's impossible to have any religious convictions at all and not exclude most of the people in the world. I'm sorry. It's just that there is no one, because there is a plurality of options, there's no one religious group that is the majority. And if you go into other assumptions, you have much smaller than you're part of a much smaller group than the main religions of the world. It's impossible to have any religious convictions without excluding the sincere convictions of the majority of the world. This is because pluralism is real. Ideas about God are real and different. Some of them, in certain ways, do contradict and exclude each other. And if we exclude the truth claim of another person's belief, That is not intolerant in the original sense of intolerance. That is just stating a fact, stating something that's true. We may be intolerant in making this statement, in having this conversation, but that's for other reasons than that we differ from them in our ideas of what is true. That's because we are stubborn, or we are rude, or we are arrogant, or there's a lot of ways to be intolerant and shamefully just antisocial by the way we speak about our faith. So my grievance with the relativist isn't for being intolerant. My grievance, relativists can exclude my beliefs, and that's okay. It's a free country. My grievance with the relativist is not because it excludes me, it's for not being honest and admitting about excluding me. It projects a false taste. I want relativists to admit that they exclude my beliefs and not try and pretend that they're including everybody's beliefs under the humble flag of tolerance. My aim here is very practical. I always try and get someone who comes here who was influenced seriously by relativism, try and get them to come down off their high moral ground onto a level playing field with me, where we can sit on the grass together and have an honest talk, one stubborn absolutist to another. And when we frame it that way, that can come off strangely often. We're in the same position. We both believe things that exclude each other. We're both not likely to let them go right away, just at a whim or hearing one discussion or argument. But let's talk, and we can hear each other's stories. We can learn about each other. We can care for each other. We can love each other. We can even try to persuade each other to change their minds and have a good relationship. So that's where I would want to aim here in a lot of this discussion, is to get people to see, it's not to put people down, but to get them to see we're on the same level playing field here, because you believe some things, I believe some things, they don't work together, they don't go together, let's talk. Now finally, not finally, but getting toward the end here, the new tolerance as an attack dog. This is where the new tolerance in the name of diversity, in the name of tolerance, really comes and starts to do things that really I think are just the opposite. And having heard this, it shouldn't surprise us that the new tolerance can turn original tolerance on its head, especially when it comes to evangelical Christian faith and ethics. I think there's a lot of irony here. Out of its supposed commitment to pluralism, diversity, and against discrimination, it has used tolerance to eliminate specifically Christian expressions of pluralism or diversity. This place is diverse and tolerant, but not for you. It's here that we see the bite of Daniel Taylor's line: America is sick of intolerant people, and it's not going to tolerate them anymore. And it shouldn't surprise us that we're in that those are considered intolerant. Some of the best books written about tolerance I've come across are things like The Intolerance of Tolerance, that's one book, or When Tolerance is No Virtue. These are people writing about what has become of modern tolerance and saying, whoa, it's just backfiring and doing something completely opposite from what it's intended. I give one example here of the Supreme Court case, Christian Legal Society versus Martinez. I think it was 2010. Has some very sobering consequences. 5-4 decision. The decision is written by Justice Ginsburg. Against a Christian fellowship group at Hastings College of Law that they decided to de-recognize on that campus. It was denied official group status on the campus. It wasn't thrown off. It wasn't prohibited from being on the campus, but it was de-recognized and not allowed to use the communication system, the email systems, or use campus property or get subsidies, as all other groups did for occasions and so forth. This is because the Christian Fellowship wanted to have leaders of their group, or insisted that they wanted to have leaders of their group who believed in the Christian faith and in Christian moral standards. And they would only accept people in membership or leadership who were Christians, this is a Christian group, and lived by Christian moral standards. The law expected them, or the decision was that, no, you've got to accept all comers who are in this law school into membership and or leadership of your organization. All comers. In other words, you mustn't require someone to be a Christian or to follow Christian, in this case sexual morality, in order to be a member here or a leader here. You must have all comers. And the fact that the Christian group did not allow all comers to be members of the group or leaders of the group, that was seen as discrimination and not allowed. And they were closed off, they were unrecognized because of that. They wanted leaders, the Christian group wanted leaders who were respected and lived by Christian, were Christians and lived by Christian sexual ethics. But that was unacceptable. And because it discriminated against those students who were not Christians and didn't particularly follow Christian sexual ethics. The same case was amplified. Because this Supreme Court case, a lot of universities and colleges followed them, Vanderbilt, Tufts, Bowdoin, a number of private colleges. None of them were thrown off the campus, but they were delegitimized, derecognized, whatever, as official groups, meaning different things in different places. But the force of the ruling and its application is disconcerting. It was the Christians being just minimally Christian, it would seem, were bringing an unacceptable diversity to the school. They for some reason wanted to choose leaders who actually believed in the cause or reason that they had a group, that they created the group. They who believed in the reason that the group existed and gave the group its identity. The result was intolerance and discrimination against a group who wanted to have its group mean something that could be lived out. And to me, this is tolerance used to achieve less diversity. And this is where the irony of it all is. It's tolerance turned to achieve less diversity on that campus. What does that leave if the group obeyed the ruling? What would happen if they didn't discriminate and allowed anybody to be a member and a leader? If they allowed all comers, how could the group keep its identity? And many have pointed out it would tend to require a group to be entirely privatized and trivialized and have no issues that they really cared about that could be disagreed about in their membership or leadership, because this is when tolerance is the only virtue, because they will be allowed none. Any public voice of the group would be silenced. By the U.S. Supreme Court criteria, if just thinking back a number of years, if Martin Luther King had been an undergraduate and tried to start a Christian civil rights group on one of these on a campus, he would not have been allowed to discriminate against racist students being a member of his group and being leaders in his group. Not that Justice Ginsburg had this in mind at all, because they don't have anything like it in mind, what it really is implied by what they're doing. I was interested to come across Ohio State University, who rewrote its guidelines to read, a student organization formed to foster or affirm the sincerely held religious beliefs of its members may adopt eligibility criteria for its student offices that are consistent with those beliefs. And I think, whoa, what a brilliant idea. What a terrific idea. And just a sensible resolution to the problem that allows a group to have a continuing identity as a group that has been felt to be important to them. Okay.
Dick, what was that Supreme Court case?
That's, what is it, the Christian Legal Society versus Martinez. Martinez, M-A-R-T-I-N-E-Z.
That's the one at UC Hastings.
Yeah. Okay, winding it up now. What I try to clarify is the change of the words, the use of the words that surround the idea of tolerance, so we can understand what's going on and know what we're bumping up against. Words and terms that don't stay put. We can expect that in today's world there will be the Christian faith as a revealed religion with real truth claims about God and morality will turn up offensive in a relativistic setting. The society all around, and we're likely to be targeted. You know, this discrimination against groups on colleges, delegitimization, derecognition, I find it very disturbing and so on, but my goodness, compared to what persecution Christians have felt in the past, this is child's play. This is, we mustn't feel we're put out so far. I'm sure it's hard on the people involved in it, but even then, the group could continue on the campus. So I'm not trying to say, what we're suffering is ghastly. But it's important to see what's happening and what could happen more. I wouldn't be surprised if our offenses will tend to be in our failures to be tolerant, according to this new sense of tolerance. Again, in Rome, the early Christians were persecuted not for worshiping Christ, that was fine, that was okay, but for not being inclusive to worship Caesar as well. So you bring a revealed religion into a completely relativistic, pluralistic setting, and it jars. And will be received that way. I've tried to suggest questions for us to challenge us, so we can push back. We can challenge back to what are simply often accepted assumptions that are just assumed and not even argued for. But a key part of all this is how we are ourselves tolerant in the original sense of the word, as we relate to people. As we speak, as we write, as we interact, as we with our friends and our neighbors, that's going to be what we'll talk about this afternoon, and shifting more to that perspective. So let me end there, and I guess we can take a break now. I won't take questions now. Let's all have a break, and then we'll come back, and then we're going to have a time just for discussion running to lunch, because we really believe in discussion here, and we'll go there.
About 15-20 minutes, something like that.
Oh, yes, good idea.